talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, a new look at the Irish Civil War, where the fighting took place and how many were killed. Rituals and belief in pagan Ireland and the links with the wider world. And to end the show, the forgotten Irish radicals whose dream of a communist future brought them to Moscow in the 1920s. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. The centenary of the Civil War has promoted wide-ranging research into that tumultuous and complex period in Irish history, and a new book contributes to that research with new insights into regional, national and international dimensions, the first ever listing of all Civil War fatalities, and original explorations of propaganda, gender, trauma, culture, labour, land and class. The book is called Atlas of the Irish Civil War, New Perspectives. It's published in hardback by Cork University Press. The editors are Helene O'Keefe, John Crowley, Donal O'Driscoll, John Borgonovo and Mike Murphy. There's a foreword by the president, Michael D. Higgins. And I'm delighted to welcome one of the editors, Donal O'Driscoll, to the show tonight. Donal, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much, Patrick.
This is part of that wonderful Atlas series. So maybe first of all, remind us of the Atlas series and how it brings all of these new perspectives to Irish history and Irish research by bringing together the best of new researchers and new scholarship.
Sure. I think probably the kickoff for this particular phase of the Atlas series was the Atlas of the Great Irish Famine back in 2012 that John Crowley and Mike Murphy were involved in as well. And that really set the bar high, you know, it was hugely successful, award-winning, etc. And then we followed that up with the Atlas of the Irish Revolution in 2017, which was a huge book, if people remember, famous for its weight as much as its content. But we really tried to, in that we set the bar even higher, I think, in terms of bringing in, you know, hundreds of scholars, everyone working in the area, and tried to present quite a complex story in a very accessible and attractive way. So make it scholarly, yes, based on academic rigor, but also accessible to the broader public. And a key part of that, of course, is maps. And maps are, you know, a window into the past that capture sort of temporal and spatial patterns and tell the story very clearly for people in a way that text maybe sometimes can't. We also emphasize, as we do in this new book, imagery, rarely seen documents, rarely seen photographs, you know, high production values. So these are all little windows into the past that sort of help in terms of accessibility, I think. So we very much try to follow that pattern now in this new Atlas of the Civil War, New Perspectives. And it sort of has arisen, as you suggested there at the beginning, from the whole commemorative sort of atmosphere, the public attention that's been brought to the Civil War for the first time in a long time, I think. You know, it has been pretty much a neglected topic, not just historiographically, but also in terms of public history and public engagement. And, you know, famously people say in schools, you know, we ended with the end of the War of Independence, the Civil War was never engaged with. And that sort of crept out into the public realm, I think, to a large extent. And there was a certain reticence to engage with the Civil War. But that's been blown away now, I think. I mean, in terms of the passage of time, generational change, the withering of Civil War politics, the peace process, I guess, has been important as well. And much more. So in the context then of the commemorations or the centenaries decade, we in the Atlas of the Irish Revolution research team, who continue to sort of work on various online projects and so on, were involved in several projects to mark the centenary of the Civil War. And out of those came the need for, or the obvious sort of potential for this new Atlas.
It's a wonderful collection of scholars. It's a wonderful collection of essays. And talk to me about how you decided to divide it into these different sections, because it is very much a multidisciplinary approach where it looks at the provinces, it looks at land and labour. There's a whole propaganda section, a section on the dead, a section on gender. imprisonment, the global dimension, legacies, that it really does look at it in a very focused thematic way.
It does, and it, as well as, I think, what we're really trying to get away from, and you know, what the new scholarship is driving, I think, is getting away from those old binaries, those old sort of, you know, dichotomies, if you like, you know, Collins versus Dev, you know, militarists versus politicians, or, you know, irreconcilables versus pragmatists, you know, and this constant sort of dichotomous sort of understanding and how it's presented, and also the focus on personalities, you know, Collins, Dev being the most obvious. And then beyond that, of course, the military focus, right? That civil war was about the National Army versus the anti-treaty IRA, you know, the military engagements, all of that. And all of that is interesting, and we deal with all of that, but with much less emphasis on those aspects, and more emphasis, as you say, on the bigger picture. How did the civil war impact on ordinary people? How did it intersect with issues of class and gender? You know, how were ordinary lives affected in terms of property, in terms of transport, in terms of the newspapers people read? What information did people have? What were they allowed to read? How did they understand what was happening? And again, that goes back to what I was talking about in terms of using posters, using documents from the time as sort of windows into how people might have perceived events at that time, and not in terms of how historians or other commentators have framed the issue subsequently, you know, and maybe framed it in a way that really doesn't accurately reflect how it was experienced at the time. So we broaden it out from historians as well. We have archaeologists involved in terms of Laura McInachney's work on the graffiti of Kilmainham Jail, for example, women's graffiti in Kilmainham Jail. We have studies of caves in County Sligo that were used by the anti-treaty IRA, by archaeologists who have worked on this. We have memory studies, we have gender studies, as you mentioned, and political scientists. You know, we cast the net wide, and we try and get as many perspectives as possible in order to reflect the multifaceted nature and the complex story that was the Irish Civil War, rather than just Collins versus Dev. Simplicities, really.
And it's not just essays, you also have these case studies. So, for example, one on the songs of the Civil War, another by Terence Dooley on the 1923 Land Act, that allowing you to take an in-depth or a specialised focused look at some of the more interesting aspects of the whole thing.
Yes, I think that's a good point. Using, you know, experts in the area to look at key aspects that sort of illuminate the general theme of that section, whether it's on the dead, on legitimisation, on imprisonment, or whatever it happens to be. And our, you know, captions, mostly they're little mini essays. Sometimes they're up to 800 words and plus. Again, by ourselves mostly, but also by invited scholars in a particular area. So if there's a particular photograph or a particular image, then we will, you know, really layer it in terms of supplementing the key chapters in the book. So there's many layers to it. See, this is a complementary volume to the Atlas of the Irish Revolution, but it's not really a follow-up. You know, it's really, we call it New Perspectives for a reason.
And how do you think we view the Civil War now, 101 years on? Have we reached a different point in the way we approach it? Because for so long it dominated Irish politics. It was the great divide. It was the great trauma of the 20th century. But we seem to approach it in a much more nuanced way now, I think.
I think so, a much more mature way. I think a much more objective way, a more fair-minded way. And when we saw through the decade now, and, you know, of course there was official reticence about it, or official fear about how to commemorate and so on. I think the state did a decent job, actually. And I think the politicians did a very decent job in terms of acknowledging, you know, the crimes on both sides, the wrongs on both sides, and acknowledging the tragedy for all really of Irish society, of how the Civil War, why the Civil War emerged. I mean, it didn't have to happen. I mean, the what ifs are very much part of our book as well, the peace moves, the other possibilities that were there. So I think, you know, the Civil War was a tragedy. It was a big mistake. It didn't have to happen, but it did happen. And it continued, as we do a section on legacies, and Fergal Garry does a brilliant overview of how the Civil War infected and infused the political discourse and the nature of Irish politics subsequently. Not all is sort of bad, in fact. I mean, he kind of argues that the stability of the democratic survival of the Free State had a lot to do with the way that Irish politics was structured because of the Civil War, and it sort of elided what plagued other democracies in terms of multiplicity of sectional interests, class interests, and various clashes. So there's a lot in there, but I think we've reached a point, and I think we're trying to kind of present this book not as a definitive official history, despite the president's sort of endorsement of it, certainly not a closed book, but as the latest contribution to this evolving history, this increasingly mature, fair-minded, balanced history. And I think, you know, that's only for the good.
And Andy Bielenberg and John Dorney have done a fantastic job providing this index of the fatalities.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty astonishing, really. It was obviously through the Minister for Arts, came on board and funded this research project, which has been integrated into the Atlas and is also available through the IrishRevolution.ie, which is our website, and also through RTE History, where we have an actual interactive maps done by Charlie Roach, one of our cartographers, where you can really mine down into each individual fatality, but 1,425 violent deaths in total in the Free State. First time that's ever been properly nailed. Okay, it's not definitive. There will be tweaks, but that's as close as we have to a definitive figure thus far. I mean, in the past, people were guessing 4,000, 5,000 people dead. It wasn't that. I mean, relatively small number of deaths. 647 pro-treaty, 438 anti-treaty. Again, that's new because a lot of people assumed anti-treaty deaths outnumbered pro-treaty deaths, and 336 civilians. We see the kind of spatial patterns of those deaths. We see the temporal patterns. July and August, the beginning of the Civil War, was the high point. And again, towards the end in March 1923, or the early months of 1923, when the Civil War was really centred around Kerry, was the other high point there. But what's really interesting about what they do, I think, from my perspective, is the social profile, the occupations of the dead. You know, we really see the clear social differences between the two sides. The fact that National Army soldiers were more likely to have, you know, what you might call a lower social status, coming from unskilled backgrounds. About half of the fatalities on the National Army side were from unskilled working class backgrounds. Less than one third of anti-treaty victims came from the same social class. They were predominantly skilled workers, lower professionals, and farmers or farmers' sons. So there's a clear difference for a whole variety of reasons. I mean, IRA volunteers joined an unpaid guerrilla army for a range of, you know, political motives. They didn't join for employment, whereas most National Army soldiers were poor. They were looking for a steady income. And that had knock-on effects in terms of the course of the war, in terms of actions and so on, in terms of memorialization as well. But we feature every single fatality that John and Andy have identified in almost a memorial wall. And we see that really as a kind of a memorial to the dead, because many ordinary people who were caught up, as well as those who were actually involved. And, you know, we've tended in the past to commemorate only the great and the good, really, the leaders. And this is all the ordinary people whose lives were given for what, anyway.
Your own contributions are really interesting on the propaganda war, and also looking at censorship during the Civil War. How much censorship was there, and which side won the propaganda war?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, actually. I mean, what I set out at the beginning, I kind of look at from the initial treaty split, so from sort of January 1922 to the outbreak of Civil War in June, that very interesting sort of 6-month period. And that's the War of Words began immediately. Once the treaty was signed, the War of Words began. And I kind of look at how censorship operated in that context. Structural censorship on the side of the pro-treaty side, because basically 99.9% of all newspapers in the country supported the treaty. So that you might call that a form of structural censorship. And in reaction to that, what some newspapers call sledgehammer censorship was carried out by the anti-treaty forces, who sort of smashed up the Freeman's Journal, seized newspapers, attacked journalists and so on, because of their frustration with this pro-treaty consensus. So then once the war itself starts at the end of June, the provisional government established a military censorship under Piers Beasley. And Beasley was very under-resourced in that, but he succeeded very well in putting a control in terms of how the conflict was reported, but also the words that were used. It was really about legitimization of the Free State and delegitimization of the anti-treaty forces. So this is where the famous term irregulars was enforced on the newspapers. You had to refer to the anti-treaty IRA as irregulars, not as Republicans or anything else. They couldn't be given military designations. They were not troops or forces. They were always bands of armed men. So they were bandits, they were terrorists, and so on and so forth. So that was really about the legitimization. On the other side, of course, because the Republicans or the anti-treatyites controlled Munster, at least for the month of July or into early August from the beginning of the war, you had a sort of a censorship and propaganda operation operating there, whereby the Cork Examiner, the Cork Constitution and other newspapers in Munster were taken over by the Republicans, by the anti-treaty IRA, and were used as a propaganda platform and were heavily censored in that sense as well. At the end of the day, the anti-treatyites had to produce their own, because of the newspaper consensus, had to produce their own papers, Public na hÉireann being the main one, another Sunday paper called The Plain People, and a whole range of smaller papers. They were really swimming against the tide. I mean, the pro-treaty side not only had the mainstream press behind them, but also their own paper called The Free State and a whole succession of other papers run by Arthur Griffith and other experts in the area, if you like. And I think in terms of the overall war, the war of words, I think it was probably won by the pro-treatyites in conjunction with their military victory and their political success. But in the longer term, perhaps that really wasn't the case, in the sense that it was really only 1931, I suppose, that some balance was restored to the media landscape when De Valera established the Irish Press, and that became such a huge factor then in Irish political life subsequently.
As you said, the volume is notable for the maps and all of that, and there are also so many other illustrations, photographs, archival documents, that it really does bring the era, brings the conflict alive, because you actually are able to look at these images from the very time.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, not only portraits, photographs, paintings. We use a lot of paintings. We like that whole visual dimension, and the cover, of course, is Sean Keating's An Allegory, which reflects, again, Keating's Men of the South, which were used in the atmosphere of the Irish Revolution. So there's a direct connection there. And I think it's a fabulous painting that Emer O'Connor, the art historian, makes a very interesting sort of analysis of it on the inside the cover in terms of what it represents. And people will see it for themselves. It's the famous painting of the pro-treaty and anti-treaty soldiers burying a coffin with a tricolour in front of the ruins of an old big house, while the artist himself and Mother Ireland are laid against the tree. It really captures so much in there. We also have we like to use material history, buildings, uniforms, post boxes, stamps, things like that bring out the texture of change at the time and of conflict. Graffiti, I mentioned already. Cartoons, I have a feature in it on the cartoon war, as I call it, because cartoons were... there's a lot of very funny cartoons and a lot of very really interesting political, polemical cartoons on both sides. And they both use cartoons to sort of undermine the other and to big themselves up. And some of them are extremely well written. Many of them are well rendered. Many of the anti-treaty cartoons by Grace Plunkett, of course, Grace Gifford Plunkett, who was famous, of course, made famous in the song Grace, and was the widow of Joseph Mary Plunkett, and she was one of the prime caricaturists on the anti-treaty side, along with Constance Markovich, who delighted in caricaturing the great and the good of the Free State side in a very funny way in many ways. But really, these images and documents, they're very much a window into the past, and we try to use the highest resolution and the clearest so that people can read the actual diary entries and the and the letters and so on of the time, and really get a flavour of how people were experiencing what was happening.
Well, it is a wonderful window into the past. It's called Atlas of the Irish Civil War, New Perspectives. It's published in hardback by Cork University Press. My thanks to Donal O'Driscoll, one of the editors, for joining me tonight to discuss it. He's edited along with Helena O'Keefe, John Crowley, John Borgonovo and Mike Murphy. And there is, of course, the foreword by the President of Ireland, Michael D. Higgins. Donal, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Pat. It was a pleasure.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back. We're talking history. Driven by a very human desire to make sense of the world and control their lives, people created sacred spaces and monuments to facilitate communication with the gods and with ancestral figures. A multiplicity of sacred phenomena were a part of everyday experience, with landscapes and objects often holding unworldly meaning. Archaeologists frequently come across puzzling evidence for ritual activity, and a new book explores a wealth of these discoveries. The work is a survey of the many rituals and beliefs that were vitally important elements of life in ancient Ireland over several thousand years, from 4000 BC onwards. The book is called Pagan Ireland, Ritual and Belief in Another World. It's published in paperback by Wordwell Books. The author is John Waddell, and John, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Hello there.
Can we begin by talking about this book? Why you decided to write a book about pagan Ireland?
Yes, I think I wanted to do two things. I wanted to show a wide readership just how fascinating archaeology can be when it explores some of the lesser known and darker regions of the past. Many archaeologists would say that we have lots of evidence for ritual activities, but the building of tombs like Dewgrange and the burial of the dead are obvious examples. But these archaeologists would also say that we really can't understand the beliefs and religious beliefs that lay behind these practices. Because obviously in prehistory, without records, we simply don't know what people believed. But I think it's possible to make an educated guess from time to time. And that's what I tried to do in Pagan Ireland.
It seems that the veneration of these older gods, it continued even after the arrival of St. Patrick and the bringing and the coming of Christianity.
Exactly. That was the second thing I wanted to do, because the victors always write the story, and the Islands of Saints and Scholars was to a certain extent a reality. But I think actually that pagan practices continued long after the introduction of Christianity. And we now have a growing body of evidence that would support this thesis.
And can we talk about then some of the things you did discover in the course of your research? What surprised you?
Well, one of the most fascinating things, I think, that has been discovered by other archaeologists in recent years is the complex way some people treated the dead in prehistoric times. One of the instances that I cite comes from a tomb at Carrowkeel in County Sligo. This is a famous cemetery of passage tombs built and used before 3000 BC. And one of these monuments was excavated rather poorly in the early years of the 20th century. And they found human bones and bits of pottery. And they were able to sort of, well, recognize that the dead had been buried in what we would call a disarticulated condition. And this unfortunate condition means that the dead, well, the bodies were exposed, it was thought, to allow the flesh to decay. And then you put groups of bones in the tomb. And this practice of disarticulated burial was very common. And it was obviously practiced at Carrowkeel as well. But recent microscopic analysis of some of the bones that have been preserved demonstrated that the bones bore marks made with a flint blade, a very sharp blade. And it was very clear that the corpses in this case had been dismembered very carefully by somebody, by a practitioner who knew how to dismember a body very carefully. And if you think about it, that meant that the corpse had to be defleshed, disemboweled, and possibly the brain removed in a long and protracted ceremony. And why do that, I asked myself, because it would be much easier to let the corpse decay naturally and be exposed to weathering. But these bones showed no signs of weathering. And I think that actually this probably reflects a very sophisticated religious belief, because in various mythologies around the world, there's a belief that the earth was created from the dismembered body of the first man. In other words, mountains were made of his bones, plants from his hair, and earth from his flesh. Now, this is a very sophisticated belief, and it means that possibly dismembering a corpse was almost a reenactment of creation. And it suggests that perhaps at Carrowkeel, we had almost sacramental practices being undertaken as part of the rituals for the dead. And this shouldn't surprise us, of course, because in present-day Christianity, for example, the Eucharist is a reenactment of the Last Supper. So have the notion that an ancient event, real or imagined, could be reenacted as part of a process, a burial process, is a distinct possibility. And this might indicate that these people in County Sligo before 3000 BC had actually some very sophisticated religious beliefs that lay behind their funerary rituals.
Yeah, it definitely does seem very sophisticated. And what I also found extraordinary and very intriguing was the fact that you see parallels with indigenous societies in other parts of the world. And why was the sun so important for these people?
That's a very good question, because today, with artificial lighting, we forget that once the sun set, darkness fell. And everyday life was ruled by the sun. And we have traces of sun worship going right back to well before 3000 BC. And of course, in Ireland, the rituals associated with the sun penetrating the chamber at Newgrange at the winter solstice is only the best known example of this. But there's solar imagery in gold and bronze at various stages in Irish prehistory. And so we can be pretty sure that throughout that huge time span of pagan belief, the sun was to the fore the generator of fertility. And there was certainly a belief in Ireland that the sun travelled across the heavens, perhaps in a great boat, and sank in the western seas and travelled under the earth to rise in the east and to bring fresh light and warmth to the earth. So I think the sun figured in everyday life in a way we can hardly imagine today, when we just associate it with tanning and sun cream.
And you mentioned fertility there, and there is a huge number of fertility rituals as well in pagan Ireland.
Yes, I think people were focused on fertility because life depended on it. And one of my favourite illustrations of fertility in that book, I came across it when looking at the evidence for iron working in Africa. In prehistoric times, iron was made in Ireland in what was called a shaft furnace. This was a sort of a clay cylinder about 2 feet high, and you'd put charcoal in at the bottom and you'd drop the iron ore in at the top, and using a bellows you'd heat the charcoal to melt the iron ore in this cylindrical furnace. And we certainly know in Ireland that blacksmiths and iron workers had magical qualities, but in Africa there are some indications that it was even more interesting from a fertility aspect, because some clay shaft furnaces in Africa have female breasts on them, and even belts that are worn by women to enhance fertility. And the creation of iron was almost perceived as a fertility act and a sexual act, hence the breasts on the shaft furnace. And maybe someday in the future, somebody in Ireland, some lucky archaeologist, will find the remains of a clay shaft furnace and should look very carefully to see what is engraved on the exterior, because none have been discovered to date as far as I know. But there was definitely a very strong sexual and fertility element to the production of iron in prehistory. It was a process of giving birth to a new magical material, in effect.
And it's interesting what you say there about the archaeological evidence and the, you know, whether some new archaeological evidence might be discovered in the future, because the book relies on archaeological evidence, cultural evidence. And I wonder, given that these are prehistoric times, how much of it are informed, educated guesses that you're making, and how much can you be absolutely certain that this is what they believed and this is what they understood at the time?
That is the key question. And some of it is simply informed speculation. But the notion that, for example, the sun crossed the heavens in some fashion, perhaps in a boat with bird's head prow and bird's head shaped stern, is actually to be seen on Iron Age metalwork. There's a small object in the National Museum that depicts this mythical process very well. So there is occasionally some proof of ancient beliefs. As I said, the notion that the sun should be borne across the heavens in a container or a vehicle of some sort. But elsewhere, I have to confess, yes, this is simply an informed speculation. But someday, possibly, I mean, as I said, a shaft furnace fragment might be found with some indication on it of a fertility nature. So archaeology is forever producing new surprises and new discoveries. So I live in hope that some of this speculation will be proved to be correct in the future.
And it's fascinating, as you say, these new surprises, the new discoveries, and some wonderful illustrations in the book as well to just bring home exactly what this is all about.
Yes. I mean, one of my favourites is an illustration I got from a colleague in Germany from the State Museum in Halle of a female shaman or a witch doctor. And this woman lived many thousands of years ago. And when they discovered her body, she was covered with shells and animal bones and painted with red ochre or paint. They were quite rightly assumed she was a shaman of some sort, capable of, you know, all sorts of magical activities. She suffered from a physical deformity of the spine, which would have caused her to have involuntary movements and spasms of some description. And this disability may have given her, you know, certain magical qualities. And there's a very imaginative reconstruction of how she may have looked, with deer antler horns and animal bones forming various decorative pieces on her body. And there are various Irish burials of women with some sort of physical disability, and in some cases accompanied by antler bones that may be the remains of women who were women with special qualities, the Mná Fhasa, the wise women of Irish folklore. And this may have been a widespread phenomenon too. Some women were magical practitioners.
It's a fascinating story indeed. The book is called Pagan Ireland, Ritual and Belief in Another World. It's published in paperback by Wordwell Books. The author is John Waddell. And John, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back. We're Talking History. Hotel Lux follows Irish radical Mae O'Callaghan and her friends, three revolutionary families brought together by their vision for a communist future and their time spent in the Comintern's Moscow living quarters, the Hotel Lux. And the story is told in a brilliant new book, Hotel Lux, An Intimate History of Communism's Forgotten Radicals. It's published in hardback by Footnote Press. The author is Maurice J. Casey. And Maurice, you're very welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Patrick. Really great to join you.
Can we begin with the Hotel Lux? What was it and what made it so special?
So the Hotel Lux, it began life in the pre-revolutionary period in Moscow. It was originally set up by a Moscow baking dynasty known as the Filipovs. But the Bolshevik regime took control of it in 1919 and converted it into the living quarters for visiting revolutionaries from all across the world. So it became this real kind of melting pot of all the various people who traveled from India, from America, from Britain, from Ireland, and from really every corner of the world where there was a revolutionary party. And they all came to the Hotel Lux. And that's what made it so fascinating, the interactions between all these different radicals.
And central to the story is Mae O'Callaghan, a Wexford-born translator and sometimes described as a mystery woman. But you've managed to go beyond all of that mystery and reveal so much about her life and her career.
Yes. So Mae O'Callaghan began for me as a pseudonym in an old out-of-print communist memoir from the 1930s. I was able to crack that pseudonym and was really fortunate that so much material relating to her had survived, mainly in archives in the US, but I also managed to trace living descendants of those who knew her, who had also maintained a lot of material. And really what so fascinated me about her story was thinking through how this woman who was born in rural Wexford in 1881 ended up living this life, first in Vienna, then in London during the suffrage struggle, and then in Moscow in the 1920s, before dying in obscurity in 1973 in North London.
And tell me about how she ended up in the Hotel Lux and the incredible network of connections she made, the friendships, the relationships, because it's that story that really draws out really how you can use the Hotel Lux to really tell the story of what's happening in that period.
Yeah, so she ends up at the hotel because during the years of the First World War, she lived in East London. And she was part of the East London Federation of Suffragettes, which was a feminist organization led by Sylvia Pankhurst. It was on the left, it was explicitly socialist. But what you find in East London is also a huge community of East European Jewish residents, many of them Yiddish-speaking, Russian-speaking. And that is, I believe, where Mae O'Callaghan first picked up her ability to speak Russian. She could also speak French and German. So then when the Russian Revolution occurs in 1917, it's widely welcomed in the East London left. And the Comintern, this international organization dedicated to spreading the revolutionary abroad, it specifically needs people with skills like those that Mae O'Callaghan had, the ability to know her way around a typewriter, but also to speak these languages that were so important to the movement, namely English, French, German, and of course, Russian.
And there are some wonderful people that she becomes friends with, including various anti-fascists, poets, journalists, people involved in the Red Army. Like, it is an incredible cast of characters.
Yes. So some of my favorite stories are just those of the remarkable legacies of the friendships she made in the hotel. One of the women she befriended, a woman called Emmy Leonhard, belonged to originally from a very wealthy German family, but then ends up in the anti-Nazi resistance along with her partner, Edo Femin, in the 1930s. And Mae O'Callaghan actually stayed in touch with this woman until her death in the 1970s. And she was there in May 1925 when Emmy Leonhard's first daughter was born in the Kremlin hospital. And that daughter, Elisa, spent her first months in the hotel. There's also the remarkable friendship that Mae O'Callaghan had with Olga Minskaya, who was the highest ranking woman at that point in the Red Army. And she also became an acquaintance of Vladimir Mayakovsky and Sergei Eisenstein, two very well-known figures of the Soviet avant-garde in the 1920s.
And before that, she'd become friends with Sylvia Pankhurst when she was in Britain. And this was when the First World War was breaking out, and Sylvia was involved with the feminist journal, The Woman's Dreadnought. And Pankhurst seems to have had great affection for May, describing her as having the Irish gift of humour and being impressed with her charisma and personality.
Yes. Well, Sylvia Pankhurst had an affection for Ireland more broadly as well. The Woman's Dreadnought got a scoop in 1916 when it became really the first journal in Britain to publish an eyewitness account of the 1916 Rising. And really, you can't understand that level of connection to Ireland without thinking through Sylvia Pankhurst's own intimate connections to Ireland through her friendship and working alongside Mae O'Callaghan and other Irish women on the staff. Another point of the Pankhurst story that's really important for Mae O'Callaghan is that that's where she met another one of her lifelong friends, Nellie Cohen, who was from East London Jewish background, who was Sylvia Pankhurst's secretary. And they also remained friends all the way through the Moscow years and then on to Mae O'Callaghan's death in 1973.
So how difficult was it to research and write this book? Because the archives are mainly in Russia. There are difficulties tracing and tracking them all down. So how much was involved with bringing together all of these primary sources?
So it took me 7 years in total. And during that time, I also learned Russian in order to be able to carry out the archival research in Moscow. I was fortunate to visit in 2018. Such an archival trip wouldn't be possible now following Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But I also needed to, because Mae O'Callaghan and her world is very obscure, it's not the world of the well-known political figures, I managed to trace personal archives. My first great success came in 2017 when I traced the archive of a woman that Mae O'Callaghan had helped raise. And that archive was actually only a 30-minute bus ride away from where I was doing my PhD. It was in an attic in the Cotswolds. And in that archive, I actually found a huge box of love letters that was sent to this woman that Mae O'Callaghan raised by another woman whose life story really begins in the Hotel Lux. So I was able to kind of reverse engineer those letters and then trace that family through those love letters to northern Spain. And in 2021, I visited Spain. This was, of course, after the pandemic had delayed my research trip. And there I found another vast archive of incredible material, all relating to this woman, Emmy Leonhard, who had been close friends with Mae O'Callaghan in the hotel. So it's really been an enormous adventure. And it's been one that's really been shaped by the past 7 years and the turbulence of world history, whether that's the pandemic or war or climate. It's been really interesting to think how history as it is made now has shaped my ability to tell this history itself.
And in terms of these experiences in the hotel Lux, how did the various different shifts and changes in the Soviet Union affect their lives? And I'm thinking of the rise of Stalin and the Stalinist terrors. You talk about the children of one particular Irish couple, Patrick Breslin and Daisy McMacken. They're involved in various translations. And then Patrick, it becomes one of three Irish victims of the Stalinist terror.
Yes. One of the threads of the book is really understanding how the terror, the purges, impacted the figures in my book on a personal level. May O'Callaghan, when she befriended Nellie Cohen in Sylvia Pankhurst Circle, also befriended her sister, Rose Cohen, who was one of the British citizens who were executed during Stalin's terror. So in the 1920s, what you find is an atmosphere of hope in the Hotel Lux, as people think that the revolution could go in any which way, in any direction. And that becomes converted into one of a nightmarish atmosphere by the 1930s, where you have this large community of particularly exiled German communists and Spanish communists after the defeat of Spain in the Spanish Civil War, who become suspect because of the xenophobic strain of the terror. And many of the rooms in the Hotel Lux empty out as their occupants are arrested, disappear into the gulags, or are executed as a result of the terror. So one of those stories that I really try to bring out is how those disappearances were either confronted or even ignored by those people who survived because they left at the right time. They left the Hotel Lux in 28, 29, and they never returned to Moscow. They didn't need to live with the consequences. They didn't need to face the oppression and persecution that people like Patrick Breslin or Rose Cohen faced in Soviet society of the 1930s.
There are various love stories at the heart of the book, but a very interesting love story between Joyce and Elisa.
Yes. So this really, what the book builds towards is this love story that I discovered, and these two boxes of love letters that I found, one in an attic in the Cotswolds and the other in a garden shed in Galicia. Joyce, who was raised by May O'Callaghan, her mother was Nellie Cohen, May O'Callaghan's friend from East London, and her father was actually the Irish novelist Liam O'Flaherty, who met Nellie Cohen in 1928 and seduced her in a London hotel room. Elisa, meanwhile, was born in Moscow in 1925 in the Kremlin Palace Hospital. And it was May O'Callaghan who gave her mother, Emmy, the cab fare to bring her to the hospital when she was due to give birth with Elisa. And so these two women, as adults, met after the Second World War, and they met through May O'Callaghan, and they fell in love. And so for me, that was really the most remarkable discovery that really encouraged me to write this book, to tell this love story that owes its beginnings to events that took place within the hotel in the 1920s. And the remarkable nature of the fact that not only did this relationship take place after all the catastrophes and cataclysms of the 20th century, but that so much material relating to this romance survives, decades of love letters between the two women, which have survived in two separate private archives.
And Morris, when you have all of these radicals and idealists and dreamers, how did their idealism and dreaming survive the reality of what happened in that Soviet state?
Yes, well, this has been something that's just been so interesting to me in the research, is the ability for these people to continuously both confront and think through what these disasters that befell them and their movement meant for their own political ideals. There are people in this book who ended up entirely disenchanted and disillusioned, but what I've really focused on and tried to bring out are those people who went back to those basic ideals and rethought about how what this was all about was a world of justice and equality, and how do you build a movement that reflects that? I think that the questions that they asked have a contemporary relevance. The answers, of course, proved wrong and proved so fatally wrong in many cases. And so really, for me, that's what's interesting about this generation. One, that they prove the case that you don't necessarily need to get more right-wing as you grow older, but also that they thought like us. The things that they desired were, in many cases, the things we desired: a world of equality, justice, and social harmony. And so it's important to recapture their experience and to think through what went wrong and what went wrong on an intimate level, because so much of this is just about how people interact with one another based on political ideas, how they fell out or fell in love based on the shifts in wider international politics.
What happened to May then in the end? She died in 1973, I think, as her health declined. She ended up in a nursing home, but really only a small group who really were left to who knew the full extent of her life and career.
Yes, yeah, so her funeral was attended by just two people, Nellie Cohen, her friend from the suffrage struggle, and Nellie's daughter with Liam O'Faherty, who she had helped raise, Joyce. She, once she returned from Moscow, she spent a few years in New York trying to make her career there as a journalist. That didn't work out, and she settled into a kind of a quotidian day-to-day life back in London, working in a left-wing bookstore and helping to raise Joyce, this child that she felt partly a mother of because she had introduced Nellie to Liam O'Flaherty. Mayo Callahan's life is one of those ones that disappears in the historical record because she didn't have the position in the movement of a leading ideologue or speechmaker. She was the person who kept the revolution running on a functional level, translating, typing, working behind the counter of the store. And for me, it's just been a real privilege to be able to reconstruct the life of someone like that, someone who was really on the ground level in these amazing historical events, and who experienced it in a similar way to which we might experience it, with an ordinary person's gaze and with all the vulnerabilities and compromises and complications that come with that.
You talk in the book about going through various Comintern files in the Moscow archives, and some of them are huge files with huge levels of details about the people. And I'm wondering how much, what were they being scrutinized and under supervision and under watch while they were at the hotel Lux? How much of an eye did the authorities and the secret police keep on them? Were they monitored? Were they constantly under supervision?
Yeah, so the Comintern archives are just really fascinating material in Moscow. The Comintern kept thousands of personnel files on people who came into their orbit and people of interest. I think I'm probably the first historian to have ordered up the Comintern's personnel file on Eamon de Valera, which was actually very dull. It just consisted of a who's who in entry. But with the radicals who they became suspicious of or who they felt were veering towards a heretical line, like people who may have had Trotskyist sympathies, what you find are these, in many cases, massive files. One really amazing file that I encountered was that belonging to Joseph Freeman, who was an American communist who was born in Ukraine and knew May O'Callaghan in the Hotel Lux. He wrote a memoir in 1936, which was what led me to discover May O'Callaghan. And what I found in his Comintern personnel file was essentially his book, his memoir, being put on trial. It was read over by people who were trying to basically make a case of political unreliability against Joseph Freeman, but also it fed into the investigation of some people he had known in the hotel who had stayed on into the 1930s, a German communist known as Heinrich Corella, who was under suspicion in the hotel. You have these accounts as well of the hotel in the 1930s being a place where people did not feel like they could express any critical opinion because there may even be listening devices hidden within the radiators. So again, a very different atmosphere to this one of relative openness and hope that someone like May O'Callaghan would have experienced in the 1920s.
And finally then, Seamus O'Reilly has a great quote about the book where he talks about how it's a fascinating tale of exiles and emigres, zealots and dreamers. And it really does capture that very well, everything that is going on in the Hotel Lux.
Yes, well, I certainly hope so. It's been a real research adventure. And one thing that I've really tried to keep an eye on whenever I've been in an archive or looking through old newspapers are these small little details that often don't get written into academic history. Things like the color of the carpet or what was written on a banner on the wall or what the food was like. May O'Callaghan was a lifelong vegetarian, and that also feeds into how people describe having food with her. So those kind of everyday details about what exactly it was like to live in this hotel, and to live in a hotel where it wasn't just people like Mayo Callan who were the ordinary functionaries of the movement, but there are people who became major figures in the movement who lived alongside her, who lived in that hotel, people like Tito, Antonio Gramsci, a young Ho Chi Minh also spent time in the hotel. So really, it's about trying to capture that experience that was common to that generation, and that room, those specific rooms of the hotel, and how history all played out within those corridors.
Well, that's a fascinating study. The book is called Hotel Lux, An Intimate History of Communism's Forgotten Radicals. The book is published in hardback by Footnote Press. The author, Maurice J. Casey. And Maurice, thanks for coming on the show tonight.
Thanks so much, Patrick.
Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marisa Sullivan, and Peter Malloy on sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.